live entertainment with local musicians, West Coast Black Bear, and Izzy BM. Hear a report back from your board of directors and get to know this year's candidates. Record your fondest memories of KBOO in a minute or less at the Mic to the People booth. This is an all-ages and disability-affirmative event. Again, that's the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, Saturday, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, featuring West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2019. Remember, your voice matters.
KBOO Comedia Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Stephen Marley, Babylon by Bus Tour on Friday, August 30th at 8 p.m. at the Roseland Theater in Portland. The second son of Bob and Rita Marley, eight-time Grammy-winning musician and producer Stephen Marley, will perform in Portland with DJ Sasha Pena, who will be opening the show. Again, that's Stephen Marley, Babylon by Bus Tour on Friday, August 30th at 8 p.m. at the Roseland Theater, 8 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On today's show, we'll speak with writer and journalist Timothy Faust about his new book, Health Justice Now, Single Payer and What Comes Next. Then we'll continue our coverage of healthcare in America with Jennifer Block, also a journalist, whose book is called Everything Below the Waist, Why Healthcare Needs a Feminist Revolution. That's coming up in just a moment. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The movement for a single-payer healthcare system in the U.S. has been organizing for years, but only in the past couple of years has it gained steam after relentless Republican attacks on Obamacare. A majority of House Democrats have now signed on to a bill that would establish a Medicare for All system in the U.S., but skepticism still abounds, even within the Democratic Party. Critics consistently insist that a Medicare for All system would cost too much without taking into account all the costs, including profits, that the current system eats up. At this critical moment in the fight for healthcare for all Americans, we turn to a timely book, Health Justice Now, Single Payer and What Comes Next. Its author is Timothy Faust, a writer and journalist with expertise in the healthcare system and the single payer system in particular. He's written for Splinter News, Jacobin, and Vice, and now joins me. Welcome, Tim.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. So let's first clarify some terms. We hear the word single payer usually conflated with Medicare for All. Your book subtitle has the word single payer in it. What is the difference between these terms? And what does single payer even mean? It sounds like a little bit of a wonky term.
Sure. So single payer and Medicare for All, at least in the U.S., refer to the same thing. Medicare for All just happens to pull a little bit better, so people tend to use that term. What single payer is single payer is a healthcare finance model in which everybody's healthcare needs, whether they're medical, dental, vision, or long-term care for folks with disabilities, are covered in full by the federal single payer without any like copays or costs to use at the point of service. So right now, if I want to go to the doctor, I need to have insurance because medical costs are just way higher than what I can afford on my own. So I need to have insurance, I got to pay premiums, couple hundred bucks, $500 every month, and then I got to find a doctor. I got to find a doctor who's in network, who contracts with my insurance company. I got to go to the doctor, I got to pay a copay for the office visit, then I got to pay whatever my insurance company bills me at the end of the visit, and then I got to pay whatever the doctor bills me on top of that after the insurance bills me. Under a single payer model, if I got to go to the doctor, I just find any doctor who's around who I want to go see. I go see the doctor, I get the healthcare I need, and then I leave. It's free to use at the point of service. There's no costs attached to it. It's a much more humane and easier to use model.
It's certainly elegant. And if you listened to the Democratic debates that took place in early August, the detractors of Medicare for All who wanted to strengthen the Affordable Care Act had a much harder time explaining the ins and outs and intricacies of that system. But on the Medicare for All system, their single point of attack seem to be it's going to cost too much, it's pie in the sky, it's fantasy land. The cost is what we always hear. That's a red herring, as Bernie Sanders has pointed out. How do you explain that in your book about cost? And if, should we even worry about something that you know our actual healthcare depends on? I mean, even talking about cost seems a little strange about something that's so critical for so many, for all Americans.
Sure. You've got a couple of things there. I'm going to go through a couple of them. Unit costs, overall costs, and then like how spending should be done in general. First of all, unit costs. How much a particular item of healthcare costs, whether it's a Band-Aid or a knee surgery or some other kind of procedure. Those in the U.S. are astronomically high, and they have been made high because we have a really weak multi-payer model in which there's no strong force pulling costs down. There's no cost regulation. The average inpatient procedure in the U.S. costs 40% more than the exact same procedure performed on the exact same patient when performed in France. You've got MRIs, which cost five times more, the same machine doing the same exact scan when performed in Australia. All these unit costs are astronomical. What a single payer can do is bring these costs down by acting as a de facto price setter. A single payer says, hey, we negotiate on behalf of 330 million people. We're willing to pay $1 for every Band-Aid. So either take our price or leave it. And virtually every hospital takes it because they don't want to miss out on that big pool of customers. So that's unit costs. Single payer is much more equipped than like our current private model to handle these things. Private models are just too small and too weak, and they can't negotiate with hospitals or other doctors. That's why Aetna, for example, pays between three and five times what Medicare pays for a given medical procedure. Then you've got total medical costs. It's called NHE, National Healthcare Expenditures. Right now, we spend $3.5 trillion on NHE, and we get some of the worst outcomes of any country that spends similarly. The worst first world country as far as like what our return is on our healthcare spend. It's projected that a single payer, because it can reduce costs, would actually only need to spend $2.9 trillion in NHE. It's actually a cost-saving measure. And we can, right now, two-thirds of that $2.9 trillion could be funded through what we currently spend on Medicare, Medicaid, the VA, all these programs combined. And the other third would come from things like payroll taxes, wealth taxes, financial derivative taxes, wherever you want to tax folks from. And so what that means is that we just take all the money you're currently spending on premiums, copays, deductibles, your share of the insurance that your employer sponsors, all these things that add up, and instead of giving you one blanket tax sum, and it ends up being much smaller than the big pile of things you accumulated in the first place. I think the Sanders plan projects that a family of four making $40,000 a year would go from $5,600 in annual healthcare expenditures to $400 under a single-payer plan. So the costs are really, we're not building a new healthcare model on top of the one we already have. We're just reallocating the money we currently spend to make things more efficient and take care of everybody, which is really a crucial part of the process. Then as far as like what should we spend, I mean, personally, frankly, I think we should spend whatever it takes to make sure our people are healthy and have what they need, right? Healthcare spending is very high return. You compare it to warfare spending or arms spending, in which every dollar you spend, you get 80 cents back. I think with healthcare spending, it's like in the 4 to 7 range. You put $1 in, you get $4 to $7 back. But there's a lot of jobs, a lot of work, a lot of like transfer and value being created in healthcare markets. Personally, I don't think that, like, we got to spend our money somewhere, and I don't think spending on healthcare is a bad idea. Actually, one of the points of the book that I want to touch on is the idea that healthcare is a thing that happens beyond just the operating table, right, in the hospital. And so once a single payer is forced to bear all the costs of providing care, but also bear all the risks and costs of what happens when care is not provided, like, for example, if you live in unsafe housing conditions and there's mold in the walls, or it's flammable, or you don't have any housing at all, you're going to get much sicker much more often than you would from, for example, stage 4 cancer, right? You die from exposure way faster than you die from cancer. That's a really expensive cost. And right now, nobody really bears that cost. Sometimes hospitals do, but nobody really bears the cost of what happens when people have unsafe housing or not enough food.
So sort of public health issues.
Right, totally. Nobody really suffers. Nobody's bottom line is really impacted by public health issues. Maybe Medicaid, and they build things like housing programs. But a single payer has the size, the weight, and the resources to really invest, I think, in programs beyond just hospital.
One of the comebacks to the issue of Medicare or Medicare for All system being able to drive down costs overall is you have critics saying hospitals are just going to shut down. Doctors will, you know, find other vocations because a Medicare for All system would drive costs down too much. What do you make of that?
I don't think that's accurate, right? Right now, hospitals have to spend a lot of time and a lot of money dealing with the fact that a large portion of their customer base could be uninsured. They've got massive billing departments. I think it's 50% of a doctor's time in a week is spent dealing with billing. 60% of nurses' times are spent arguing with other nurses at insurance companies about how much they got to bill. All that is wiped out. You've got way more productive hours you can spend in the day. Also, everybody who comes to your hospital is insured. You're guaranteed to get paid for everybody who walks in the door, and you know at what prices and what costs. It provides hospitals a stable business model instead of this massive secondary industry of trying to gouge private insurers and spend all this time going back and forth and being combative. As far as doctors, what I think I'm really interested in is med students. I think right now, med students go to med school and they accumulate $200,000, $300,000 in debt, then go out into the job market, and the jobs that look most appealing are, you know, being a hand surgeon, being a plastic surgeon, being a high-paid cardiologist. And so the kinds of doctors we need, primary care providers, GPs, family practitioners. So I think a secondary program or like a secondary initiative or secondary fight to the fight for single payer is the fight to make medical training, whether it's med school, nurse training, home health vocational training, free, or offer really generous reimbursement programs. That's the way you make sure you have enough doctors by driving down the cost of going to school to keep a program going.
Let's talk about that broader framework that you discuss in your book. Your book is called Health Justice Now. That's not a term we use often enough when talking about the issue of healthcare. What do you mean by health justice?
Sure. There's just your health is not a thing that just happens like in a hospital, like I said, right? Your health is impacted on, do you have housing? Do you have food? Do you experience racism? Do you experience sexism? Do you experience poverty? Do you experience exploitation by your boss? Do you not have a job in the first place? All these things affect how your health manifests. And so to really assess health or healthcare or how we approach health as a society, there is this big, I'd say, intersectional, interlocking approach that we got to consider all at the same time, right? If your people are suffering because they don't have access to housing, whatever, then housing is healthcare. If your people are suffering because they don't have access to food, so they get diabetes or comorbidities like cardiac failure, then food is healthcare. Needle exchange programs are healthcare. Rehab is healthcare. Transportation is healthcare. If you're a dialysis patient living in a rural area, you can't get to the dialysis center in time. You lose your spot in the line to get an organ transplant. Transportation is healthcare. All these things have fundamental roles in how you experience health. We understand that, for example, black men receive worse heart health care than white men. Black women experience 3 times the rate of maternal mortality than white women. And so you could conclude from that like race affects health, but that's not true, right? No, black people aren't born differently than white people and have worse health conditions. They just, racism is the driving factor. Racism affects one's ability to receive health, along with structural poverty and structural sexism. And these things can't be untangled by just insurance, right? Insurance is not enough to really untangle all these problems that weave together. So I think a broader idea of health equity, of health justice, lets us kind of tease apart the different things that affect our health and joust towards them all at once. Mm-hmm. And just because insurance can't solve the problems of structural racism does not mean single payer is inadequate to the task. Because single payer, I think, is the only thing that's even possible to really confront these problems, these obstacles. All these problems are exacerbated by a for-profit, multi-payer model that restricts your access to care. So a hospital CEO or an insurance CEO can get paid $2 million a year. I mean, they're really like, they've got their hands in the pot making these conditions worse. I think only a single payer that is, again, forced to bear the costs of the consequences for these problems can begin to tilt against them.
So if we are at a stage now where the fight for single payer has ratcheted up, do you feel that the current Medicare for All bill introduced in the House by Pramila Jayapal, in the Senate by Bernie Sanders, adequately meets what you would consider a single payer system that, you know, could eventually encompass these other public health issues as well? Or is this just a first step?
Yeah, well, they're always the first step, but I think Jayapal's was the first battle-ready single-payer bill. Mm. I've got a couple of components a single bill has to include. It's got to have one mandatory, like, pool of all people, like everybody in, nobody out. It's got to offer comprehensive care, medical, dental, vision, and really importantly, long-term care for folks with disabilities. That's where Sanders was weak until he fixed it, I think, in March or April of this year. It's got to have federal funding, federal standards, federal oversight, but I think local implementation. Healthcare in Boston and healthcare in California and healthcare in Ohio, healthcare in Boise are all different from each other. And you wouldn't have local agencies kind of controlling their own disbursement of dollars, meeting the federal standards. Jayapal's bill has room for that. And lastly, it's got to have budgetary tools so it can kind of muck around with new payment models, things like global budgeting for hospitals, just general tools that are essential to keep costs where they need to be. Jayapal's bill has all of that. Sanders' bill was a little bit weaker, but he came around on long-term care, I think, after Jayapal's bill really set the bar. He doesn't have all the budgetary tools, but they're pretty strong. They can be reconciled after they're passed. But yeah, these are finally, I think, the first like bills that really can be put into the fire and examined and fought for.
What led to this moment? I mentioned that the attacks on the Affordable Care Act by Republicans, in a way, inadvertently seemed to create an opening for single-payer advocates and also kind of expose the internal battle that went all the way back to 2018 between advocates of those who want to see a private health insurance system remain in place and flourish and those who would like to see health insurance companies be taken out of the mix altogether. So now you have establishment Democrats scrambling to save the ACA. You have single-payer advocates pushing for single-payer. And you have Republicans claiming they have some as-yet-to-be determined health care bill that would be better than everything else, but not actually coming forward. What led to this place, and how do we move the needle towards single-payer?
Sure. So I think one of the reasons that when the ACA was passed in 2012, 2013, there was not a lot of advocacy for it from the White House, right? Obama passed it and kind of walked away because it was politically vulnerable. Really, the first person to really create a lot of advocacy for the ACA was Paul Ryan by attacking it and by attacking measures like protections for pre-existing conditions that people found were really important. I think the reason single payer is on the rise now is because costs are skyrocketing. Like it's at a point where I think The average American family can't afford a $400 medical procedure, but premiums are already higher than that. The crisis is imminent, right? The crisis is in all of our bodies. We all understand that we are just one, you know, a wrong turn of the steering wheel, one fluke ion from microwave. We're all one freak accident away from drowning in catastrophic medical debt. And I think we all are leaving our kids behind or seeing our kids get sick. And I think we all understand that pretty intuitively, pretty inherently. The ACA has really failed to make things better for a lot of people. It's done a lot, especially the expansion of Medicaid, but it hasn't done enough. It kind of believes that you can take the things that are breaking the model, which is private insurance companies, and somehow make them play nice and make things line up, but that never works. And all these things like Biden Care, Medicare Advantage for All, Healthcare for America, whatever plan.
Kamala Harris's plan that she calls Medicare for All, but isn't really.
Right. They're all trying to take these broken toys that have caused these problems, these private insurance companies, and get them in line. It's like adding rungs to a ladder when you're drowning in quicksand. It doesn't do anything. It's meaningless. You're sacrificing the power and the ability and the financial backing and the general humanity of what a single payer can do to just keep private insurance companies profitable. That's really all it is. They don't want Aetna and Blue Cross to close or get mad. They don't want to step on anybody's toes. So they're offering these really milquetoast half ideas. And those aren't interesting. Those don't speak to me, at least. Those don't recognize the dignity or humanity of people and give them what they need. And I think people really respond well to universal programs. If you give somebody something, they're going to fight to keep it, and they'll want to get on to the next thing and fight to keep that. People generally like Medicare. People generally like having Medicaid. I think these universal programs are simpler to understand, don't have massive carve-outs for private companies, and really address the core problem face-to-face instead of kind of dodging and hiding behind obscure policy bills.
And it seems as though the Republican approach to healthcare has been to just whip up anti-immigrant sentiment in their base. Their base, who would benefit directly from a single-payer bill, is simply angry about the fact that, there are arguments around whether immigrants would come into our country for the free healthcare funded by our tax dollars instead of just focusing on the actual issue at hand, right?
I mean, the Republican plan for healthcare is Mad Max's Thunderdome. It is nothing. It offers nobody anything. It's punitive. It's harsh. It's regressive. It actively destroys, if not hunts down, people who have disabilities, people who are sick, people who are poor, people who are hungry. And yes, it's wildly, like, a lot of their rhetoric is wildly xenophobic. I believe a single payer has to include healthcare for everybody in the country, including non-documented citizens. Right.
Right. I mean, if you or I go to Canada today and get sick or have an injury, whether we're Canadian citizens or not, that healthcare system funded by Canadian taxpayers will serve you and will not bill you.
Right. I mean, one, it's the right thing to do, obviously. Everybody is a human being who deserves to be safe in their own bodies. But if you want to get pragmatic, there is a massive quantity of wealth being built off the backs of the labor of undocumented immigrants, right? They're contributing in a massive way to our GDP and the pockets of wealthier people who are using their labor. It is only the just thing to do to return upon them and other people who visit the U.S. Healthcare that they're helping pay for in the first place.
It's amazing that we don't stop to think about some of the built-in assumptions into our current system that just rarely get questioned, which is, why are employers involved in the administration of health insurance? I mean, it's sort of a weird thing that you would get your health benefits through the job that you are in if you're not over the age of 65, and a single payer system would not only free employers from having to provide health insurance, free up unions from having one less battle to deal with, it would also free up employees and to being able to take whatever job they wanted, because it would suddenly not be tied to benefits.
Right. I mean, the relationship between employers, employees, and insurance is an accident of history, right? It's a relic from World War II. When employers could get tax benefits, they could get around wage freezes by offering insurance to their employees, if making the jobs that they were offering more attractive, and it got to stay in place after World War II. But that's like an accident of history, things merging at the wrong time. It's not like any kind of like way that insurance has to work, and actually it has really deleterious consequences. I like that you brought up the example of unions, right? Unions have pretty good to great health insurance, but that it's still cost increases for that insurance every single year. And the time and money and power they spend fighting for that insurance comes at the expense of money they could be spending fighting for better wages, workplace safety, and better conditions. So I think, yeah, this is I think, a great emancipator, right? Right now, if your employer is a jerk, he or she controls your access to things like blood transfusion, hormone therapy, contraception, all these things are within the purview of your employer to decide for you. If you have an abusive employer or if you have an abusive domestic partner from whom you get insurance, they have power over the health care you get and the health care your kids get. And that's buck wild to me. That is totally insane. That is a kind of employer domination that you don't see elsewhere in other countries. Mm-hmm. And so single payer does a lot to help folks kind of walk away from these exploitative relationships and have the freedom to organize, freedom to protest, freedom to do things they can't do now because they're afraid of losing their job. Like, for example, I just got employer-sponsored insurance at the beginning of this year, and it's amazing. Now I only got to spend $220 a week instead of $500 to see the doctors that I got to see, which is still a lot of money to spend, and I could barely afford it. But now I'm really afraid of losing my job or walking out or getting fired because I can't afford to not see a doctor, but I also can't afford to see a doctor if I don't have insurance.
Right. Yeah. So many of these issues that just don't sadly enter the national conversation when discussions around single payer come up, which is why, of course, you've written a book about it that people could certainly read. You write in your book about the pharmaceutical industry, and I'd love to just focus on that for a bit, because this is a sort of a different set of companies, and the issue around drug prices is also a very, very big part of the conversation. You know, Bernie Sanders in a high profile insulin caravan took a bunch of type 1 diabetes patients across the border so they could buy cheaper insulin. And now Canadians are upset because they think that Americans shouldn't be taking advantage of the low prices that they negotiate. And the U.S. could certainly negotiate those low prices themselves, but they seem so beholden to the pharmaceutical industry. Should we be including conversations around the pharmaceutical industry as we do about the health insurance industry in these conversations around health justice?
Absolutely. I think one thing we should begin exploring is the public manufacturing of generic drugs, right? If we produce things domestically for domestic use, we can do a lot to really drive down medical costs, pharmaceutical costs. Drug companies never play nice, and there's three actors in the reason why drug prices are very high. It's pharma companies, it's insurance companies, and it's a third group of companies called pharmacy benefit manufacturers, PBMs. And the three of them together get into this like tripartite antagonistic dance in which the results are just skyrocketing drug costs year over year over year. And because they all benefit in different ways, or at any given point in time, two of them are benefiting, things aren't going to change. I think taking steps to bring to realize that a lot of drug research is done by public entities, by underpaid or unpaid grad students, and their work is then bundled and sold to for-profit pharma companies. And taking that work back and producing drugs domestically, publicly, I think is a really, really good first step to taking on pharma kind of more face-to-face, more full throttle.
Finally, Timothy, I just want to kind of address the broad framework around how our healthcare system is so tied into a profit-making system currently. Any talk about single-payer healthcare immediately elicits accusations of socialists from Republicans who seem to think that that's a good line of attack, and then that gets some of the establishment Democrats into these defensive postures. But I mean, maybe we should come out and explicitly say that capitalism does not belong in conversations around healthcare, and socialism is the way to go when we're talking about healthcare. Because it's the way we've decided pension plans for seniors, you know, called Social Security works well, or the Veterans Administration, or the current Medicare system. I mean, should we sort of call out the fact that capitalism has created the monster we're in today, and a socialist system could actually be a good solution?
Absolutely. I think we've given market capitalism 60 years to solve these problems, and they've made the problems much worse. Right now, if you're the wrong kind of person or you got the wrong kind of sickness, you're just thrown out in the street. You're taxed, or you're billed to death, and then your children inherit those bills and pass them forward. People are dying because they don't have access to medical care, so they go to the hospital too late and they get too sick. and there's complications. We do all these things to exploit and confuse and hurt people because they're not profitable. And the people that are remain who are profitable are insured until they become a problem, and then they're kicked off their insurance plans. They're coerced into leaving their insurance plans or can't afford to stay on their insurance plans and go on to public health care. We're already subsidizing private industry to an incredible degree by taking the sickest people and the most vulnerable people and insuring them with tax dollars. Why not use that money to insure all of us in the first place? Because the private market has done nothing. It has done nothing good in the past 50 years.
Well, Tim, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. I think it's a good book, and I hope people like it.
My guest has been Timothy Faust, writer and journalist with expertise in healthcare and a single-payer system. He's written for Splinter News, Jacobin, and Vice. We've been discussing his new book, Health Justice Now, Single Payer, and What Comes Next. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Women's health care has always been problematic in the U.S., but particularly over the last decade, with increasing attacks on women's ability to access reproductive health care, we have an inordinate amount of political attention being paid to what goes on in women's bodies below the waist. It's not just anti-abortionists and the evangelical right that fantasizes about women's healthcare returning to medieval times. Women's healthcare providers themselves are, to an extent, stuck in the past, according to a new book by my guest, Jennifer Block. She's an award-winning journalist who's written for The Washington Post, Newsweek, Reveal, and other publications. Her first book, Pushed, garnered critical acclaim. She now joins me to discuss her latest book, Everything Below the Waist, Why Healthcare Needs a Feminist Revolution. Welcome to the program, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I have to confess, reading the first part of your book made me very angry, just really, really angry, because you cite examples of women who go to the doctor when they have a problem, usually involving their reproductive organs, and no one listens to them, and they have to scream and shout and fight to get heard, and often they end up worse off, or needing even more medical attention. And every woman who's an adult woman can probably relate to some version of these stories, and it's pretty infuriating to think about how commonplace it is. Is this sort of unique to women? Men don't go through this, I guess?
You're not the first person to tell me that the book is making them angry. I wrote this book because I think if we're going to talk about how our power is undermined on the basis of gender, on the basis of race, on the basis of circumstance, and as feminists, we're talking about Me Too, and we're talking about Black Lives Matter, and we're talking about the pay gap. We also need to be talking about how our healthcare system is failing women specifically. One in three mothers give birth by major surgery today. One in three women lose their uterus to a hysterectomy by the age of 60. And yet, our maternal death rate is rising. Women's life expectancy in the United States is not keeping up with peer countries. In fact, it's declining in 40% of counties. We're getting too many of the treatments and surgeries that we don't need and not enough of the ones that we do. And women are not the only ones to be undermined in the medical realm. I want to be clear about that. We have a very broken system that's affecting all of us. And we have, you know, on top of our lack of universal health care, we have poverty, racism, a lot of factors.
A broken healthcare system, of course.
A broken healthcare system. Yeah. But I think that that women are uniquely vulnerable. I mean, we cut into or remove the uterus more than any other organ, regardless of sex. Mm. And this treatment is affecting our health, our lives, our sex lives, and our ability to participate in society.
So let's talk about the fact that women do have complex reproductive organs because, of course, our bodies are capable of conceiving and growing and bearing other human beings. So it is a complex system that does require care. And of course, we do have more and more today women entering the business of providing these healthcare needs, right? There are a lot more women OBs than there were before. And one would imagine that that would have made a big difference, hasn't it?
That is a great irony. And I think that was the hope of the women's movement of the 70s and going forward, that if we just got more women into the profession, which at the time was very male dominated, that it would change things. But the fact is that childbirth, for instance, we intervene medically in the birth process more than ever. We have not been able to get that cesarean rate to budge. And today, 85% of OBGYN residents are female. So things haven't changed all that much. And, you know, I think we need to look at the history. Of course, we have a lot of skilled, well-meaning providers with good intentions who went into the profession to do good and take care of people. And that's really the motivation of most healthcare workers, especially today. It's not, you know, it's not a fun system to be a part of. But if you look at the history, it's only 100 years ago that what I call a hostile takeover happened of birth. Really, you know, birth was taken care of by midwives, and the medical profession, which was just trying to get itself together, really came in and took women into the hospitals, attracted women into the hospitals, women participated, but turned birth into something that women did upright, with support, with social support, with the expertise of midwives, and made it something that doctors really did to them. So put women flat on their backs, gave them drugs, extracted babies with forceps. We're not that far from what happened 100 years ago.
Hmm. We might imagine that those medical interventions save lives, that infant mortality, you know, would be much higher if we didn't pull babies out with forceps, etc. But that's not true?
Our outcomes don't show that at all. We have some of the worst outcomes in the industrialized world, both in terms of the outcomes for babies. We have very high rates of preterm birth, low birth weight. But our outcomes for mothers, our maternal death rate is actually rising today. And it's especially dangerous for Black women. Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy or childbirth. Our outcomes don't show. Yeah.
Let's talk about the story of the pill, the contraceptive, the oral contraceptive that women can take to have healthy sex lives without getting pregnant. The story of the pill you tell in your book, how does it illustrate the attitude towards women's healthcare? Because the pill itself has evolved dramatically.
So the pill, I find, is a really interesting conversation, and it's been a difficult conversation, I think, for feminists to have. We think of it as revolutionary, and it was. I want to be clear that When it came into use in the early 60s, it was a very different world. Abortion was very illegal and very dangerous. As a woman, you couldn't walk to the corner store and get condoms, and other forms of birth control were restricted to married heterosexual couples. So the pill was liberating and revolutionary back then. Today, we have a lot more information about the physiological effects of the pill. So we've always known that there's a risk of blood clot. We've known that. That's been a kind of accepted but rare risk. But we have a lot of research now that the pill, or any hormonal method, so when we talk about the pill, we're now talking about the patch, the ring, some IUDs, but it affects our metabolism, it affects how we build bone, it affects our mental health, it affects our sexuality, our sexual response, from how lubricated we are to our sex drive. And so I think it's been difficult for us to have this conversation. I saw a headline that said, is it feminist to question the pill? And so I think, of course, it's feminist to talk about all the information that we have. And I question whether the pill deserves the pedestal that we've put it on.
In general, medical technology has been seen as freeing for women, right? That, women can, we might imagine, to some extent, choose their means of contraception. Some women may choose, a really extreme measure like a hysterectomy. Others may choose to stay on the pill for years. Others may choose an IUD. And if you do get pregnant and it's an unwanted pregnancy, if you happen to live in the right state, you might be able to access an abortion. And of course, it's not as good as it needs to be. But in general, medical technology and advancements have been seen as very empowering to women. Is there a problem with that story?
We have. I think we have this association with medical technology as empowering by definition. And of course, all the examples you gave are examples of how it certainly can give us control over our fertility, over our lives. But I trace back a line of thinking in feminism where some thinkers felt that our own physiology was oppressive. That menstruation is a curse and childbirth is barbaric and lactation is enslavement. And I think that ideology has hampered us a little bit, because then all medical technology becomes liberating and maybe we don't question it enough. For instance, women are being sold egg freezing right now as fertility insurance. And a lot of us have bought into that. I keep hearing from younger women who are enthusiastically freezing their eggs.
Because the idea is that if you can sort of put off having a baby, you could do more with your life, which is a very legitimate goal if you feel like that's what you want to do. But there's a problem with the egg freezing technology?
Well, it's being sold as fertility insurance. Like, it's a sure thing. Just freeze your biological clock. Put off having kids, have them later. It's checked off on your to-do list. But first of all, I'm not sure we're fully understanding what egg freezing entails. You're basically donating eggs for your future self. So you take hormones the same way an egg donor would. You have to go in for the surgery to extract the eggs. And then that's invasive and costly. Then you're freezing them, you're storing them, paying for the storage, and hoping to use them down the road, 10 years later, 15 years later. And right now, the estimate of how likely a frozen egg is to become a viable pregnancy is something around 2 to 12%.
Wow. You point out in your book that tech giants Facebook and Apple announced that they, a few years ago, that they would pay for female employees to freeze their eggs. So corporate America likes this idea because you can get more productive work years out of women?
That's one theory. We've sold this idea. And, I'm seeing essays now from women who are hitting 44, 42, 44, going to thaw their eggs in the hopes of creating the family they've always wanted but thought they had been able to delay. And now they have to go through IVF. So that's the other thing that you're signing up for if you freeze your eggs. You're signing up for the most invasive, high-tech form of creating a pregnancy
down the line. In vitro fertilization, yes.
Right. Which itself difficult. Is, you know, hormones, invasive procedures. And, you know, I'm seeing these essays from these women who are heartbroken and quite frankly angry because it didn't work. They went to thaw their eggs. Only half of them thawed properly. Only a couple of them out of the ones that were left actually were able to be fertilized, and then the embryos didn't take. And so I think that's going to be, you know, it's going to work for some women, just like IVF also doesn't have the greatest success rates. It works for some people, but it doesn't work for a lot of other people. And the other big question mark is what the risks are, both to the baby, but also to the women undergoing these procedures, taking all these hormones. We're not tracking that in any meaningful way. And there are suspicions that there's relationship to cancer. And so I think these are high-risk choices that have costs, and I'm not sure we're fully talking about them.
Mm-hmm. You talk, a lot of women in general, over the course of their adult lives, get skeptical treatment from their healthcare providers. Going back to what we started discussing and what you open your book with, there is this broad and vague criteria of disorders that fall under pelvic pain, women who feel pain in their pelvic region, and it's difficult to diagnose, and oftentimes doctors, OBs, don't diagnose it correctly. What did you find in your research that you write about in your book about how women often end up having to diagnose themselves or just fight for the right diagnosis, do their own research? I mean, if you can't really rely on your healthcare provider to help you enough, it becomes really difficult because we're not trained doctors, all of us.
Yeah, so many women have stories of being dismissed. You know, their pain is repeatedly dismissed by multiple practitioners. One of the most staggering things I learned was how many women are affected by endometriosis. It's something like 1 in 10.
Wow.
And this is a disease that can be incredibly painful, debilitating. It's essentially causes these growths to form in the abdomen outside the uterus, and they're hormonally responsive. So when the cycle comes, they bleed. And so they cause like internal bleeding, really. And then they scar and they create scar tissue and the cycle repeats. And women with endometriosis, historically, it took, you know, 10 years to get a diagnosis. Now I think we're down to 7 years. So we're getting a little bit better. But the other thing I learned is that, as one doctor put it to me, it's an area where really no one is an expert, because it's been thought of as a GYN disease because the growths are hormonally responsive. And one treatment for it has, the most common one has been to put someone on the pill to stop the cycle. But as researchers dig more into this disease, what they're finding is that it's really systemic, and it probably belongs under the autoimmune umbrella, because it's causing it's affecting all sorts of other systems. So women with endometriosis have a higher risk for heart disease, a higher risk for other autoimmune diseases and other pain disorders, and possibly a higher risk for cancer.
So this is one of those areas of women's healthcare that is there's such a great need for more research, but there isn't enough, or even just it seems as though there's a need for specialists in this area and there aren't enough.
Yes. I mean, I did an interview with a New Zealand radio, and they were telling me that they have endometriosis clinics. And I've never heard of one in the U.S.
No.
The other thing is that women with endometriosis with all those growths need very specialized surgery. It takes great skill. It's, as it's described to me, it's almost like cancer surgery. It's navigating around this complex area of the body, making sure not to disturb any critical structures or nerves. And again, I'm told this is not a specialty of GYN. And it's also hasn't been a focus of general surgery. And so there's a very small number of surgeons around the country who do the proper excision surgery, it's called. And very few women can access it. Sometimes it's not covered by insurance. Sometimes they can't find the right person. And so it goes back to, we're getting the surgeries we don't need, but not the ones we do.
Jennifer, are women being subjected to treatments that are far too invasive or overkill, if you will, than what they need? Did you find in your research that, you know, women who may need one procedure end up being told to get something much more broad and invasive and irreversible?
Well, I think that the number of cesareans falls under the umbrella of overtreatment. The number of hysterectomies certainly does as well. I mean, we can look at other countries and they have about half the rate of hysterectomy. And I think, yes, what you're saying is accurate. A lot of the women who end up with hysterectomies really needed skilled surgery just to remove symptomatic fibroids, perhaps, or they needed a less invasive treatment, and instead they lost an organ. And it's, they're often told, you know, if they're, you know, over a certain age, well, you've had your children, or you didn't, you know, you had your time.
As if that's all that uteruses are useful for, right? Like, it's just
exactly. And you know, when I talk to physiologists and physical therapists, they talk about the uterus as this keystone of the pelvis, that it's at the crossroads of all these important ligaments and nerves and blood vessels that reach into our clitoris and labia, blood vessels that reach into our legs. And so I think we're very cavalier about this organ. You know, it has one purpose, and it's important to keep it in if you might have children, and it's not important if you've already had children.
Let's talk about abortion. It's such a critically important issue, also a very politically fraught issue. Older generation feminists remind us of the home abortions that they remember that were the impetus for legalizing abortion and leading to the decision, Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade. We don't want to return to the coat hanger, you know, the days of coat hanger abortions. But given the lack of access to abortion in many parts of the country now, are you seeing a return to home abortions? And is the home abortion technology greatly improved today?
So yes, I did find a network of people who are providing abortions outside of the medical system, so underground again. But the important thing to know is that the abortion technology has changed. So we talk about abortion as surgical or non-surgical, but it really hasn't been surgery for 4 decades. Back before Roe v. Wade, abortions were performed by D&C. So physicians would dilate the cervix and insert sharp metal instruments to remove the contents. This happened.
And women everywhere have cringed listening to that last sentence.
Sorry. I think it's important, though, that we talk about what it actually means. As disturbing as it might sound. But this, you know, so this, the D&C happened under general anesthesia back then. It was an overnight stay in the hospital for those few women who could actually get legal abortions. And then right before Roe v. Wade, the technology started to change, and it really is due to plastics. We got the manual vacuum aspirator, and it's a fascinating history. I go into it in the book, but what we have today is it's not surgical. We insert a plastic cannula, it's called. It's got a soft tip. It goes into the cervix without needing too much dilation, and suction removes the contents, either manual suction or with the machine that probably most people are familiar with if they've had an abortion in the clinic. But there's a movement to really offer more manual vacuum aspiration, MVA, because it's much less traumatic, and it's not something that people need sedation for. So most people who go into the clinics today get what is called general often. It's really not general, but it's sedation. There was a great essay in New York Magazine about this, about a woman who was, you know, offered an MBA. You don't need to be sedated. You'll be able to walk, you know, walk away in 5 minutes. And she said it was the best, the title of the piece is the best abortion ever. So what's happening is that there's a network of people, doulas, some of them are midwives, some of them are just women, people who want to help, who are starting to offer this procedure, MVA, also menstrual extraction, which is a version of it that the feminists came up with in the 70s, and the misoprostol pill, which is half of the medication abortion that's offered, but it works most of the time.
I understand women are practicing on papayas to learn how to do abortions.
Yes, so I was able to find a training to learn how to do an MVA. Not something I planned to do, but I wanted to know what it entailed. And it was a day long training, and we practiced using a papaya, and that's how people are trained all around the world. And by the way, all around the world, people who are minimally trained, so clinic workers, not doctors necessarily. Most around the world are not doctors who are providing this, and they provide it very safely. So we're not talking about a return to the coat hanger days. We're not talking about, you know, dangerous back alley abortions anymore. We're talking about something quite different.
Sounds like a new edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves is in order with instructions on this sort of home abortion. And I should mention that book, of course, was seminal in kind of asserting the feminist perspective on women's healthcare many decades ago, but much has changed since then.
Yeah, yeah. And this was, you know, we have maybe this caricature version of the 70s health feminist as, you know, get your mirrors out, get your speculum, check, you know, look at your own cervix. And that was, you know, a big feature.
It was a revolutionary moment back then.
That's
women
right.
Women were taught to be ashamed of our bodies. Yeah.
And there was zero information. There were no books. Like Our Bodies, Ourselves. There were no shelves in the bookstore, and there was no internet to look up images. So it was very difficult to get information about the anatomy. So it was revolutionary. It was also stepping into the medical realm. But what the activists tell me today is that it was also really a way for women to access the cervix so they could perform menstrual extractions, which really served as early abortions. And this went on before Roe v. Wade.
And I should mention for our audience who's uncomfortable hearing all of these terms that we're talking frankly about, I think this is part of the issue too, right? Just being able to talk about women's reproductive health care and health and anatomy without casting it as shameful, and being able to talk about it matter-of-factly, because for far too long it's existed in the shadows. And I'm wondering, Jennifer, if you can also now sort of wrap up our conversation talking about what it is that you would like to see in the medical field. I mean, yes, it can be very empowering for women to do sort of home health care, but that's only something that you can do certain things with. When one needs intervention, when one really needs allopathic medicine to help, what are ways in which you would like to see the OBGYN field evolve? It sounds as though our systems are so complex and that the healthcare provider's training is not complex enough to match the reproductive health needs of women.
Yes. So one thing is that I think what we need to recognize is that OBGYNs are basically doing five different jobs right now. They're high-risk OBs, they're midwives, they're endocrinologists, they're surgeons. And in other countries with better systems, they really pick one and focus on one. They're also expected to be primary care doctors now, so they can be reimbursed as primary care doctors since the 90s. So I think that's one way that we would get the skilled surgeons we need, we would get the physiologic labor support we need. We need high-risk OBs, but we really need more midwives. Midwives are the experts in the normal birth process. Their training is to support it. That's really not the training of the OBGYN.
Jennifer, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, shedding light on some of these issues. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Jennifer Block, award-winning journalist who's written for the Washington Post, Newsweek, Reveal, and other publications. Her first book, Pushed, garnered critical acclaim. We've been discussing her newest book, Everything Below the Waist, Why Healthcare Needs a Feminist Revolution. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Good morning, it's 8:59. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up in about 2 minutes, it's Teresa Mitchell. Her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know, Press Watch. At 10 o'clock, it's the Heather McCoy Show. Heather has as her topic the new bill before Congress that broadens the definition of domestic terrorists that could be used to censor protests of dissent. So joining Heather to discuss the implications of this proposed bill will be civil rights lawyer and 2020 candidate for the 10th District, Michael Siegel. At 11 o'clock, it's Between the Covers. David Naiman welcomes Brandon Shimoda, an American of Japanese descent. He talks about his family being an enemy of the state during World War II in his book, The Grave on the Wall. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Press Watch is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza in Portland. Project Northwest is a local zine that helps promote local hip-hop and R&B artists with an emphasis on showcasing artists that identify as Black and POC, LGBTQIA+, women, and artists who experience disabilities. Again, that's Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.